This is episode 27 of the Futures Intelligence Leadership Podcast with guest Fiona Kerr. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Today's guest is Dr. Fiona Kerr. She researches, speaks, and consults on a range of topics, including the neuroscience of human-human and human-technology interactions, neurogenesis, and how good leaders create organizations that flourish. Fiona founded the Neurotech Institute to investigate how humans shape each other, how technology shapes us, and thus how we should shape technology. The center explores how we can leverage the incredible capacity and capability of both humans and AI, how we can maintain human connection in an increasingly technologized world, and how to create quality interactions and partnerships between humans and AI. In this dialogue, we discuss the limits to linear thinking, why leaders need more complex thinking, the role of emergent logic leadership in the future, how leaders set the tone of the organization through their vitalome, why leadership that inspires neural synchronization creates a more innovative and futures-ready organization, how to deal with the increasing role of technology in our lives without losing the importance of human-to-human interaction, and how leaders can create shared neural networks to increase autonomy and improve strategic decision-making. Let's listen. So aloha, Fiona. Thank you for joining me today on this podcast. And as always, I want to start with this key question of how can leadership be more intelligent about futures, given this uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change that we see in the world now and into the future?
Okay, so one of the things that struck me, probably one of the things that lured me back to do a PhD at 50 years old, was watching how some leaders were very good at strategic adaptation. Mm-hmm. They managed to sit well with the situation that they didn't know the future, that they were in an emergent situation. They could handle ambiguity a lot better than others. And one of the things that they understood really well was the difference between steerage and control. Mm. So if you try and control an emerging situation, an emerging system, a complex adaptive system, which is exactly what an organization and a world is, you can't. And all that happens is you put in rules that restrict your capability to actually listen to what's going on and to pick up the weak signals that allow you to understand what's sort of, I think the Finnish call it perking information. So what's bubbling out there that you need to pick up and to understand that you've always got, you know, an emergent process. So what becomes really important is which bits are you sort of, do you handle tightly, and which bits are you loose and flexible on? So that was a big part of, I guess, the thesis that I ended up writing, because I had a really good experience with about 30 years of working with, well, good, bad, and indifferent leaders. And I guess that lovely capability of kind of tight values and a gentle grip is something that I found was critical, whether I was working with big bureaucracies like defense right through to small, nimble private companies. So there were a few things that I noticed. One was that they had a really clear idea of what they were there to do. And that was easily shared as well, you know, past the pub test, some people call it, that you can actually describe it. And it was something that you could share down different levels of the organization. Whereas when I'm in organizations where clearly there are different agendas across that organization, that's one of the first problems, because then you're not listening with the same ear. You're actually wanting to control your area because you know what you think you want it to do, instead of actually taking in the information and finding out what is going on and what is happening. So that was an interesting thing. But those type values, we think that that's soft and an easy thing to do. It's one of the most difficult things is to have very consistent, shared, and very public values in an organization. Because that actually allows people to feel like they can rely on them. They're going to be backed up if they bring you disconfirming information. So if they bring you things that show that something's actually changing that we need to be aware of. Whereas in a very hierarchical organization, that gets shot down. People don't listen. You can only tell them what they want to hear. And as soon as that happens, that's it. They're not going to be adaptive. They're certainly not going to pick up the information that they should. And they're not going to allow people to experiment and to step out of the comfort zone. And they certainly can't pull people into that area. So one of the things that's fascinating, once you've got, I guess, a leader who has very high candor and creates trust, is they then create resilience. They create a capacity for people to trust that they won't be rescued. They won't be left to stay in the old way of doing things. They actually have to move in. They'll be nudged into that new way, but it'll be safe. It'll be something that they can depend on to be supported in doing. But they're not going to be left not doing it either. So they're going to be stretched rather than unsafe. And so when you feel stretched, that's still anxiety creating, but it's in a positive excitement almost way rather than a negative stress way.
Well, so overall, what you're seeing, I guess, although I don't want to necessarily make this about the state of the world right now, but what do you see leadership doing well in this kind of complex situation we're in now versus ones that are not doing so well?
Because I work in a number of countries and have for years, one of the things that's really interesting is complex thinkers, because that is part of what we're talking about. If leaders are fairly linear thinkers, they oversimplify what's going on, and they tend to shoot from the hip. So they tend to make a basic assumption that whatever has just happened was created by the things that have just gone before. This has created that, therefore we're going to change this. And it's just about never right. So one of the interesting things is the countries that handle this well, they look for all of that information that's relevant, whether it's in line with what they're doing already or whether it just confirms what they're doing. They're open to all of that information. So they look for that, they collect that, they have a really good long-term view. So it's not just what can we do tomorrow or a single goal. For example, we want to keep the economic part of this society on track. So it's all about still ensuring that as soon as possible we get back to economic gain, something like this. That actually ignores all of the other aspects, dynamics of what makes that social, economic, political system work. So if you're just concentrating on one thing and trying to pull the system back to that all the time, you miss everything else. And then everything else starts to pull against that harder and harder, and you get more and more problems. And then if you just still try and pull it back to where you want it, it becomes quite brittle, and in the end you get quite large breaks in certain areas where things really go wrong. So the countries I've seen work well are countries that take that complex map, long lens view of right, what is it that we actually can all agree we want out of this? What does a successful outcome look like? And quite often they've got multiple aims in the first place, really clear long-term multiple aims. And they also understand that kind of public-private social balance in a society, that in order to have a successful society, that of course it has to be economically viable, but it also has to have a really strong social capital underbelly. And in a situation like this, where people are worried and scared, and we have slogans like "we're all in it together," you actually have to show that, not just say it.
So it's interesting. It's like there is there's three things that it seemed like I'm curious about how you think they all come together. And one is being in complexity, having aims or goals, because sometimes that can be a challenge, right, in complexity. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, values, right? So we have these three kind of things, complexity, goals, and values. Can you talk a little about how those all, what do you think is the best way for them to connect and relate?
Yep. Okay, so that was actually very much what the whole thesis ended up being about. And I could talk to you for hours.
I read your thesis, just so you know. I thought it was amazing. I think it's way ahead of its time, in a sense, because it puts so much good stuff together in a very coherent way. But it's also a next level of type of thinking that's you're offering.
Oh, thank you. I need to write it as a management book, so it's not heavy. Yes. Yeah. So I guess what we have is, once we have an understanding, what I get when I'm dealing with managers and when I'm working with companies where there is a level of complexity in the way that the CEO and the senior managers think.
Right.
It's interesting how you watch them go through this almost valley of death. So you go from the situation where I can control this. This is about settling my guys down. This is about making sure that people understand, you know, the rules, the regulations. We have an infrastructure that where we know what we're doing and it's really clear. And then once you start to talk about the fact that you can't control an emergent process, you can't control, and that's people and that's organizations and that's the economic system that you sit within, then the more aware they become of what happens in complexity, that it is self-managing, it is self-organizing, it's self-correcting, that it adapts and learns, that you have to figure out the hidden feedback loops in that system. Mm-hmm. You know, what's actually rewarding the behavior that you get, because you get what you reward. Now, we know that, but very often in complex systems, those reward loops are not only hidden, but they're quite long-term. So we get back to that problem of you can't just think that what just happened was the cause of something. It's always more complicated than that. So a lot of it is about stepping back, you know, listening, again, steerage, not control, about tending and trusting, those kind of processes. And suddenly, if you can't control, what does leadership mean, is where very, very often people get to. And then they get through that when they suddenly start to think, okay, so it's a new kind of steerage and leadership. It's about pragmatic optimism. It's about being, you know, high candor and honesty, but also real clarity around what does good look like, which is where the values come in. And it's about, for me, fostering really high connectivity. So people need to be able to be, I guess, curious and creative, I guess, across structures. And the structures become more minimal as well. So you need rules, because you have to, otherwise everything becomes just chaotic. And you need structures and you need processes, but they shouldn't block people's capability to connect and to collaborate and to be creative. So you get into that beautiful discussion by delegating appropriate decision making all the way down an organization to design together what that looks like. Where is the tightness and where can you allow for flexibility? So one of the things that I think I noticed in organizations that were very adaptable and flexible and the learning organizations were that they had an enabling environment. So the infrastructure allowed for just the sort of things we're talking about. And it also allowed for kind of experimentation, but it gave people support and structure where they needed it. Mm-hmm. And it allowed distributed decision-making. So I consistently hear that people, yes, they're allowed to, you know, to make decisions. They have been empowered. Mm. But unless you give people resources, knowledge, the right to make mistakes, then you haven't actually empowered them, and a capacity to see progress and to make decisions. But it's not abdication either, because if you just let everyone do whatever they like, then that's no management at all. It's no leadership, because you just leave people, you know, lost. Mm. So deciding what you have to maintain responsibility for becomes something which is key, again, key to good leadership, in terms of ensuring that you're aware of your own filters and biases and capabilities as well, and that you're willing to step in quietly when you need to sort of push that process back to where it needs to be going. There's so many things around.
I'm curious, could you talk a little bit about, I think it plays into kind of what you're talking about now, is how leadership and their cognitive state, you know, sets kind of the tone or the state or the capabilities even, or even the consciousness of the organization itself.
Yes. So one of the things that fascinated me was I saw trends that were really consistent across good leadership and not so good leadership. And one of the, it's not just simple thinkers, linear thinkers, or hierarchies and, you know, really open, flexible organizations. That's too easy. But it is a little bit of that. When you find that people are really inflexible about how they're going to manage, and when you get change, they just tighten up the system. They tighten up their own thinking. They tighten up the organization. They become stricter because they think that's the answer. Then what you get is a really brittle system, you know, and it will just break. And those kind of people, there's some beautiful studies around, if you have really, really linear, hierarchical, oversimplistic thinkers, then the more assumed control and the more assumed success they have, the worse they are. The more their biases around the fact that they think they're successful, and the less they look for any information to the contrary. So they pick up no weak signals at all. And it's really interesting how they, people used to say to me, are they just not listening? You know, are they being awkward? They're ignoring us. And I said, no, it's not even on their radar screen. You know, their radar screen's this big, like it's an inch big. And your evidence is all out here. And they don't even see it. Mm-hmm. Whereas people who are good at picking up those weak signals that are the things that let you know what's happening out there, they are much more capable of looking widely, because it's not about them, it's about, you know, where we're going forward. There's a beautiful, easy, it's for me in some ways easy way of thinking about being strategic, and we assume that planners need to know the future and that we have, you know, plans and processes. What's really critical is if they are able to understand that, no, we're not going to know what's over the horizon. And that actually doesn't matter. So stop trying to bed that down in concrete. Know that it's always going to change. And then what you do is, you figure out, so where is the information going to come from that's going to give us those ideas? And it's usually from the edges, you know, it's from the people that intersect with the environment. And that's your front counters staff, it's your people out and about. And so have you got ways of being able to listen to them? Do they even know that they can be picking up those weak signals? Can they be fitting them into, or filtering them into this, you know, the organization? Are they being listened to? Do they know they're being listened to? how are you signaling that they're actually valued in terms of giving information that you know might be relevant? So how do you pick it up? What do you do with it? How do you put it into planning? And then where can you respond in a dynamic way when you see changes that mean that you need to actually, you know, alter your course? And that's strategic intuition. So I do some work in Finland around strategic intuition, and it's fascinating because it's much more around, you know, intuition is not fluffy, it's very robust actually. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's years, all your years of knowledge and expertise that's been balled up into a piece of sort of cognitive spider's web that just opens up, you know, in 1 second when you're trying to think of something. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, it's invaluable. And then you test that against, you know, good objective data, and you come up with the best kind of decisions when you have both.
So that's leaders super, groups, super interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. Well, I've been around tables with strategists who have very good analytical data. Mm-hmm. But then they'll turn to, you know, to you and I and say, okay, you've had 20 years in this. What do you think? And that information is relevant and it's put on the table and all of them are compared together. And you come up with a very deep, much more rounded outcome. You've still got what do we need to do? When do we need to do it by? But you've got much more nuanced, tacit and explicit type of information, because organizations that just run on analytics, they miss an awful lot of very rich data.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been working on a project. Part of this is this future intelligence idea, but looking a lot at brain science, and there's a lot of fascinating research around, you know, what happens in the brain when it's trying to look into the future or decide on strategies. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's kind of in small little circles where it exists. You can find it and dig it up. One of the things I came across was an idea of the, it's called like the global neuronal workspace, if you're familiar with that, or the workspace model of the brain. And what was interesting about it is how it's all about looking at these contents of consciousness that come in every moment, right? And how something like data and analytics is one part of that content. But it's not the only one, right? It's not the major one. It's just one of them that needs to balance the others. And the other ones that we have in there are like our values, are what we're focusing on, what types of things we're actually physiologically anticipating in the future, our lens and bias. And so it's like, it's, I think it's important, like you're saying, it's data analytics is only one little part. And yes, it's going to help and make us smarter and more intelligent, but it's not the secret sauce in a sense, right?
No, and what we have to always understand, and trust is a really big one in that, and we could talk a long time about the way that trust actually creates neurogenesis. So we will talk about that. But just on the analytical data, one of the things that we have to be very careful about is anytime we have to quantify and gain analytical data, or write algorithms or anything. We've just finished a very large project on brain-computer interfaces and trying to pick up very non-linear, stochastically dynamic data from complex systems, which are humans, via, you know, sort of linear codified-based systems, which are sort of, you know, brain-computer interfaces. So anytime you have to codify something, it means that you have to create explicit databases, and lots of data that's really relevant is tacit. You cannot codify it. So we've got quality and quantity. It's almost like we get the quantity, but we miss all of that qualitative data. Because whenever you try and codify and put it into some sort of analytical database, you have to, by nature, you have to make decisions about what you cut off and what's acceptable and how you trim it so that you can put it into numbers, basically. So you always lose nuance. It's really interesting. So you were talking about the neurons, just the thing that, oh boy, there's so much to talk about. One thing that really interested me was why, how people in really adaptive organizations, because it's always been very good, complex thinking. I call them emergent logic leaders. There's always been those people. And hopefully there'll always be those people. So it's not, you know, rocket science that we're complex and that organizations are complex. We just almost lost it for about 50 years and sort of come back to it. But what I noticed was people in those organizations were able to think more complexly, to they were better at complex problem solving, unknown unknowns. They were better at dealing with that at different lower levels of the organization. And I thought, okay, is that that they've given permission more? And partly it is. Or is it that they are neurologically getting better at complex problem solving? And it turns out, yes, they are. So then what got me really fascinated, the thesis started as a complex systems engineering thesis, but halfway through I thought, yep, that's what we build, and that's how complex systems work. That's their feedback systems. They have multiple levels of flux. They have, they're virtually unstable. You know, this is beautiful. But why do people who understand that think differently? Do they have, is it their experience? Not necessarily. Also, eventually it was, do they have different brains? Well, yes, they do. And can you change the brains? Yes, you can. So really high quality adaptive leaders, they have different brains. They have brains that light up differently when you put them in MRIs, when you want them to talk about what success looks like and how they interact. They are different in a hyperscanning situation. So if you and I were sitting face to face, because actually some of it doesn't happen over a screen, if you and I were sitting face to face and we had scanning caps on, if you were a really sort of, you know, positive, charismatic type of adaptive leader, then your socio-emotional areas of your brain would be lighting up very strongly, and you would manage to light mine up. And in fact, there's some work, there's some nascent work at the moment around watching, capping people in organizations who are not yet leaders, the younger ones, and the ones that are really strong in being able to create that interpersonal neural synchronization. Where you can get across those, not just the, you know, the images and the excitement, but the trust and the capacity to have shared neural networks about what we want, you know, vision, those kind of things. Those people are now being tracked to see whether or not they are going to be the future leaders. So those sorts of things become really interesting. Whereas the hierarchical kind of much more sort of controlling linear thinker tends to have different parts of their brain light up when you ask them questions around what success looks like and what the future should be, should hold. And it's much more around task, and it's much more around I, not we. And yeah, it's really interesting, the differences in capability. So the more you put people into a situation where they deal with unknown unknowns and they can actually act on complex problems, because it's proactive. One of the things we've got that, sorry, I'll finish my sentence. The more you do that, the better they get. And one of the things that humans need to do to actually create a new network in their brain is they need to take an action and try it, because that's one of the things with how our motor neuron system works. We need to lay down activated, you know, process pathways. So if you think about it, in a non-adaptive organization, one of the things that happens is all of the decision-making to try and fail sits at the very top. So what you're actually doing is restricting people below that level from being able to proactively try something, and if it works, to embed that neurally so that they get better at complex problem solving. And it gets very interesting once you start bringing in that whole kind of, you know, neural aspect of building a capacity for complex thinking and complex decision making.
Can you speak a little bit too about, I think this also kind of relates, you know, this idea that you're talking about of leadership really being to activate other people's brains. and create that coherence with them, and yes. and how that also plays into complexity, this idea of coherence and complexity and leadership being able to create coherence in others.
Yes. So one of the things that I guess we talk about in that is being able to, you know, re-envision for other people, you know, so that they get the same kind of view. Well, our brain does that beautifully. So if I was talking to you about a new situation, say I had a small company and I was in front of them and we had to make a change. So hopefully you trust me. And we might have been through this process before. So we have a generally positive relationship. Then when I start to talk in my pragmatically optimistic way, so it's not this is going to be really easy and it's not we're doomed. It's no, well, this is going to need work and collaborative attention and care, but you know, we'll get there. And when I start talking about why we need to change, because that's really critical. Mm-hmm. You need to respect people enough to bring them into that conversation. Because one of the things that happens when you are candid with people is neurally, cognitively, if someone gives me the information, then it might make me a little uncomfortable because we're cognitive sloths. The brain hates to have to change what we do. But that's okay. We'll get there. As long as I feel safe with you, if I trust you, then I'll step into that beautiful kind of, I think it's called the space of possibility. But quite quickly, what it does, it allows me to see the boundaries around what this emergent process is going to be. So I don't need to know exactly what's going to happen. I want to know where we're going. Mm. And then I can be quite innovative in how to get there. So I'm talking to you and I'm describing, all right, so if this is where we need to go from, you know, let's have a look at where we need to get to and how we do that. So the what is really clear, but the how can be much more flexible. And and that's where people can step in and really innovate in that space. Because when you have to do something differently, once you get over the I don't want to change, because your brain will do that. And that's about willpower and trust. Trust gives you a lot more willpower. So once the willpower is there to actually make the changes, the cognitive changes to step into you know, altering something, then you've got that frisson of excitement at the same time. And that's when people are highly innovative. So in that process, we're talking about things and we're starting to have a discussion on what might be possible. And the fascinating thing is your parasympathetic nervous system starts to fire and your immune system starts to come on board and you start to create not only oxytocin and vasopressin and those sorts of things. And that happens more, I'll tell you, if you're in the same space. So we're now talking also about not just synchronization of brains in that room, but we're talking also about the resonance of chemicals, the volatilome, all sorts of things that I could name. And you start to put out BDNF, which is a chemical that makes brand new neurons and dendrites. And the people in that room are starting to actually create a new map around the future. And so what that means is because we are in this a trusted environment, then the chemicals in your brain and your body allow for new neural networks to start forming. And think of how powerful that is. If we've got a shared neural network, then I don't have to spend all the time trying to tell you new, you know, rules and regulations around where we're going and stop you doing things. I can actually allow that to blossom and we can take advantage of what might this look like. If we take the other situation where I stand in front of you, I'm talking to you, you don't trust me. What's happened before is we've been in a situation where I've said, you know, oh, it's all going to be okay. And then I've, I don't know, fired 10% of you, or I haven't been honest. Then what happens is we don't fire the parasympathetic nervous system, we fire the sympathetic nervous system. And that's where you get the cortisol, the adrenaline, the stress, the uh-oh, what's going on. And we also actually push that out to other people. And there's all sorts of chemical interchange you get in that room as well. And through neural synchronization, we pick that up from each other as well. That's some of the work we're doing next year right now in actually moral and complex decision-making, the impact of other humans doing that with you versus just over technology. It's fascinating. So what we get then is a completely different situation in that room, neurally, cognitively, and physiologically, with the type of synchronization that's happening. So it really is the case that you're winning hearts to change minds. If people are in there and they trust you and they are clear about what you've agreed, it's very clear about the way that you get there, then that's why those values are so important. You've got a way to go. You know that even though it's going to be bumpy, that the values are very clear. So you're going to be supported when you go along that bumpy road. Then you'll step into it. And that's where the values come. But the minute that those values are inconsistent, we'll support you until you do something that I don't really want you to do, or I said I would support that, but now I've changed my mind, forget it, you know, it all stops.
So I'm curious, you know, is this kind of like I want to be respectful of your time and just wrap up here, because I know we could talk forever on this stuff. It's really fascinating to me. As we potentially move into a more we're going to move into a more high-tech world. We're using technology more and more. And with even the situation we're in right now, where we have maybe increased social distancing, contactless societies, where also technology is mediating our social interactions more and more, how does that shape, leadership, but also this human-to-human and also neurogenesis and our ability to create shared neural networks and maps?
Yeah, it shapes it massively. The short answer is we don't actually know how much it shapes it. So I spend a lot of my time on this. It's why the Neurotech Institute exists. It is about the neurophysiology of connection. So that's between humans and humans and tech. So we've just finished a large study around interfacing where we're up to at the moment with our knowledge to do with interfacing with humans and interfacing with computers and technology. And we're about to do some work, because finally it's become obvious that when people ask me questions like, oh, suddenly we want to know, you talk about you need to top up by face-to-face interaction in order to maintain trust if I'm leading a team. How often do I have to do that? Well, actually, we don't know, because we haven't looked at it yet. So at last, we're going to get some support to do that work. But what we do know from some very good studies that have been done around the world is, we know it innately, but we now also have some data around the fact that face-to-face interaction turns on different kinds of things in your brain than interaction over a screen. And there's some parts that don't ever light up until I've seen you, until I've met you. Once I've met you, more of those parts will light up when I look at you over technology. Not all. So we're still doing some work in that area. But what that means is, One of the things I've been looking at from some work in Finland that I did was the correlation between the rise of media technology as a mediator for trying to solve complex problems, and people virtually trying to do it. And there's quite an interesting correlation, and I'm not saying causation, between that and fairly short-term thinking. So that's one piece of data. Another piece of data that I've been looking at for about 10 years is, how do you make a complex decision? And how do you make a decision, especially that's That's an emotional decision. But any form of complex decision, emotion is part of that. So when we talk about taking emotion out of the decision, we absolutely should not in a complex process. So what happens in your brain when you've got unknown unknowns is it hasn't got all the data that it needs to formulate a decision. The brain's lazy, as we've said. So what it does at first is says, okay, before I have to go out and build a brand new map, you know, absorb brand new data, I'm going to retrawl all of the different data banks that I've got information sat in. But as soon as you have unknown unknowns, if you empathically connect to someone else, if you turn on that emotional empathic pathway, mm-hmm. usually through interaction, direct interaction is the strongest way, then you turn on through a motor neuron system, you turn on something called a discernment mode. You engage different chemicals through the interaction, through the neural synchronization, through the resonance of chemicals. And what that does is it puts you down a different pathway of what the brain looks for in terms of relevant criteria. So it changes it from short-term to long-term thinking, and it changes it from I just want to know what I want to know right now to what are the consequences of our behavior, of our actions. So that means that the information that is trawled up is quite different, and you get a wider, deeper catch net, if you like, of information, and you get a different process of making that decision. So we have a quite a different neural network turning on when we have an unknown situation and once we're empathically engaged. So the next question for most people is, you know, but then look at all of the engagement we have over things like social media and those sorts of things. But it's not the same. It's not the same parts of our brain. It's not the same. It's great if you want to step in and have a look at something and say, that's terrible. Here's some money towards it. Or here's a vote on what we should do. And then you've said, yeah, great. I've done my thing. And you're off again. But when you actually study people's stickability for decision making in difficult, long-term, complex problems, there still is no beating getting those people together physically, and discussing that reframing we've just been talking about, that worldview, building that shared neural net through all of those lovely things to do with brain-to-brain coupling and those things we now know go on. And then what the technology is fantastic for, which is what we've seen right now, is it's terrific for keeping up that process. But it's not an instead of, it's an as well as. So technology is a beautiful enabler when it's a human-centric outcome that we want. So I look at medtech and, you know, the incredible transformative technologies that I've been lucky enough to be part of are just wonderful. And me looking at you now is great. It's cognitively tiring. So one of the things that we all suffer from in the COVID times is people say, why am I so flat and tired? Well, we love Zoom discussions, but our brain is working very, very hard each time. And we're getting lots and lots of cognitive fatigue, and we're not getting the lovely, you know, oxytocin and vasopressin and dopamine and those things that you get from direct interaction, never mind touch, which is a huge vector. So that's another whole conversation.
It was interesting. It reminds me, there was a study I think they did, you know, I think some like high school level students, and put them into two teams, you know, and really made them antagonistic to each other, and they saw like an increasing like animosity towards each other, right? And then what they did is they had them then have a problem, something that disrupted both of their team groups, that they had to come together and work together to solve it, you know, in the physical, that it was like a physical work they had to do.
Yes.
And that physical work together brought so much camaraderie, even though like moments before they were enemies, right? And it's, so we see that time and time again throughout history, right?
We do. And it's fascinating. And there's more and more information around what happens once you have to collaborate, but how you change, because what you're talking about partly is a contagion effect.
Yeah.
So that Looking Up book that I wrote is around, one of the things is around the contagion that you can get quite quickly from positive and negative. Mm-hmm. And there's now a bunch of studies on what's called the volatilones. So that's the volatiles that we give off across each other. There's about 1,840 already that we know of.
Wow.
And it's just massive. We're just this electrochemical bag built to connect and pick up the information from the other person on where we're at, how we're feeling, levels of trust, levels of positivity. And those things, especially you said physical, the more you are working together and synchronizing, because that's physical synchronization and resonance, the more you're changing the way that the motor neuron system is putting out those various chemicals. Mm-hmm. And humans love to be in sync. I mean, even our voice, we're talking to each other. And I think it sits at 2 to 8 hertz. We get theta, gamma, delta or something from the voice. We have our ears, a radar for that. It changes our emotional state. It changes, again, our decision-making state. It's very intimate. It's why we still love radio. We'll always love radio. But we have a situation, so we've got one of the interesting things of when do people in stress situations, like a soldier in the field, when do they actually stop looking at information coming in and just pick up a radio? Because it's connecting with and hearing another human voice that becomes really critical. Mm-hmm. So we've got so many very useful ways to connect. And if we get right back to the very first question, which was around leading and building organizations that are adaptive, they're highly connective, and they have a very high level of trust and candidness and information cascade. And that doesn't mean that everyone does what they want. They're very tight in their values. But what that means is you've got a lot of that, that electrochemical positive activity. Mm-hmm. And it becomes cued when you go into a situation like that.
Right.
And you can get some parts of that when we work remotely. But I still notice that even though there's lots of discussion now around, it's terrific, we can just work at home. Well, you can't just work at home. Or we can just have our doctors over a screen. But then as soon as something happens which is a little untoward, immediately people need to be able to talk face to face. And so again, it's not trying to make technology replace human connection interaction, because there are unique advantages to both. So what we need to do is be really smart about when do you need direct human interaction. And it is creativity. It's when we want, because the creative brain, you should see what happens when you get, people together being creative. It's amazing, the neural synchronization. So when we want a creative situation, when someone's upset or they're really excited, so it's when they're emotionally, engaged or highly engaged, then that connectivity is really critical. Definitely if you have bad news or a difficult situation. And it's because of all the other things we just talked about. It's because if I can be in front of you, but I am honest in terms of I care about what's going on, and I mean it when I say we're going to get through this, because I was a mediator for years. I used to wonder why it worked if you just went there. Then they're picking all of that information up. We know when people are telling the truth, and we know when they care. And it actually changes your amygdala activation. It changes your affect. It allows you to deal with bad news better. It reduces pain. It does all sorts of amazing things. So we have this amazing power to communicate, not just with words, but with our presence and with our honesty and with our trust. So it's really great.
I think it's a great way to wrap it up, because we could go on for many hours, I'm sure. But the one way I like to end is I like to ask the guests to offer one word that they would like to leave for more future intelligent leadership. So what's like one word, if there's just that you would like to leave?
One word. Well, I guess with what I've been talking about, it would have to be trust.
Perfect. Well, thank you for your time, Fiona. I really appreciate your insights, your wisdom, all the work you've done and are doing. And I think the planet's a better place because you're here.
Thank you. Well, I think it's wonderful to be able to talk to you about it and get it out there.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.